We're turning now to Florida Gulf Coast University President Mike Martin. Dr. Martin has had a long career in education, spans nearly 50 years, including stints at University President, Chancellor, Vice President, Dean, Director, you get the picture. His PhD is in economics, but his areas of expertise are far broader. We brought him in today to pick his brain about the time that he spent in North Korea back during the George W. Bush administration. President Bush sent New Mexico Governor Bill Richardson to the isolated communist nation with a group of experts in different fields. Governor Richardson chose Mike Martin to be his education expert. Once we heard that story, of course, we could not resist, so we now welcome him to the show. President Martin, welcome back to Gulf Coast Live.
Thank you, Julie.
So great to have you back. If you'd like to join our conversation, the number to call is 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So let's start with kind of a Cliff's Notes version of your academic and professional background. Not that you ever read Cliff's Notes throughout that, but tell me a little bit how you went undergrad and onward.
Well, I was an undergrad at a little school in southern Minnesota that's now known as Minnesota State University Mankato. But when I was there, it was Mankato State. Went there for a couple of degrees, a bachelor's and master's, and then taught for a few years, more by accident than design. And that convinced me that I was going to be a higher ed professional one way or the other. So I returned to the University of Minnesota and got a degree in applied economics. And that sort of launched me on a way through the wonderful journey I've had to date. Spent 15 years at Oregon State University on the faculty. And since that time, as my friends would say, I crossed over to the dark side and became an administrator. But it has been it's been a great run.
Has it been a dark side, though?
No, it's not been a dark – well, at least not from where I sit, but I guess others could see it differently. But it has been a wonderful, wonderful career, and I think it's been a great life. I think my kids and my wife have enjoyed it as well because we've got to live in and experience some fabulously interesting communities. And it's great to be here. It's great to be in Southwest Florida for one final lap around the track. And
well, we're glad to have you. Yeah. I want to ask you, so you had the president position at New Mexico State University.
Yep.
How did that come about? You ended up in New Mexico.
Well, I had been a vice president here at University of Florida prior to that, and I had had a couple of opportunities at least to be considered for presidencies, but I hadn't decided I was ready for it or that's what I wanted to do. But New Mexico State offered this very interesting profile. I mean, it's a very diverse campus, about 47% Hispanic, about 40% Caucasian, and then Native Americans and some African Americans. So that was interesting. It's in an interesting part of the world. And so I felt that it was time to give it a try. And since I had spent a good deal of my career complaining about administrators, I thought it would be interesting to see if I could step up and do any better. And it was a great adventure. And that's how I met Bill Richardson. He was governor at the time. And we became both friends and in some ways, you know, occasionally combat you do with a governor. But all in all, we actually became good collaborators as well in the interest of the people there. And that's what took me to North Korea. But it gave me many other insights as well.
It's interesting. I never really think about it. But school administrators like that would need to deal a lot with state politicians,
mm-hmm.
you know?
No question.
Were you surprised that that was such a big part of the job?
Yeah, I really was. Having observed others over the years when I was sort of coming up the ranks of a faculty member, it never occurred to me the amount of time and effort you put in external to the university. I think it has changed. I think it's now about 70% external, whether it's politicians or donors, community leaders, alums, boosters, whatever it is, and much less time in the kind of the day-to-day grind of the camp or the great day-to-day adventure of the campus. Mm-hmm. So it was a bit of a surprise to me, and particularly in New Mexico, where New Mexico State University is a 5.5-hour drive to the capital.
Oh.
You had a real sense of the amount of time it took just to participate. But I've learned a lot from that and came to enjoy it as well.
Yeah. Do you remember the moment that you first heard you were going to be invited to go to North Korea?
Yeah. Actually, the governor's chief of staff called me up and had this question or this series of questions. The governor's going on a trip. I can't tell you when, I can't tell you where, and I can't tell you why. Would you be interested in joining him?
Like, I'm guessing it's not Disney World.
Yeah. And I said, well, there's only one day in the next several months, maybe even the next year, that I can't go, the day my daughter was going to get married. And I said, beyond that, yeah, sure. If the opportunity comes to go wherever this is, whenever it is, to do whatever, I'll trust that the governor has something interesting in mind. But shortly thereafter that, he called directly to tell me what was the plan. And then after that, I heard from the State Department and several other federal agencies to both brief me and get a little more information for security purposes. And little by little, the trip came together. But the initial contact was sort of one of those very open-ended kind of questions that you get asked just to see if you're willing to jump on board. Having been to South Korea a number of times prior to that, I was fascinated just by the opportunity to go to North Korea and see what it was like.
Well, the culture of that, the whole area there has been something that's at least of interest to you. Your kids are both from there.
My kids are both Korean adoptees. My daughter was just an infant when she came. My son was 3 and a half. He came out of an orphanage in the deep south near Busan, Korea. So I'd always had an interest. Plus, one of my closest friends from graduate school, who was a co-author on some research we did and a variety of other things, kept me intrigued and going back and forth. So I had the opportunity to publish in a couple of Korean journals. I had a chance to explore a little more deeply the relationships between South Korea and the U.S. And then the North Korean opportunity was just too interesting to pass up.
Well, it can't be like just buying a ticket and hopping on a plane and going over there. What was the process for having an entourage go over?
Well, there was 8 of us all together. 4 experts, as the governor called them. The governor himself, well, I guess there's actually 7 because one person didn't go from Tokyo to Pyongyang with us, a translator and an assistant to the governor. And that was the whole group. We left from the mainland, obviously, from Santa Fe, flew first to Honolulu and then to Tokyo on a jet provided by the U.S. Air Force. And then
what was that like?
Oh, it was a fancy corporate jet. It was pretty nice.
Wow.
We were comfortable. Then we had a briefing day or two by the State Department in Tokyo. Then we flew in at night into Pyongyang. And it's an interesting flight in because you can't cross into North Korea from South Korea in airspace. So we had to go around South Korea from Tokyo and come in from a different direction.
You had to go in over China or something?
Yeah. Well, make a big loop out over the ocean
over
and
the
come
water,
in from the north. And, again, it was one of those fascinating things because we're coming into Pyongyang and you could tell it was a city, though not terribly well lit. And they didn't light the airport until we just were approaching the airport. So you're flying in, looking out the window, and it's all dark. And then suddenly the lights came on enough for us to land.
Wow.
And we went in and they took us to – after we had to hand over our passports and fill out some other paperwork. And then we were put up in a kind of a guest house for several days, and it was, as I say, great observation for a person who just has an interest in the world, and this was very interesting.
So why did Governor Richardson, why was he chosen to lead this?
Well, he had been there a number of times on other diplomatic adventures. He had been, as you probably know, the ambassador to the UN, and had come to know the Korean observer. North Korea doesn't have a seat at the UN, but they do have a representative, and Bill had become friends with that individual, so he'd been asked to go back a couple of times. This particular instance was the case when the North Koreans had walked away from the denuclearization talks, and his objective was to reopen a conversation about bringing them back to the table. So those of us who went along as his experts got not only to see a little bit of what we were interested in, but sat for many hours in the evenings watching this negotiation take place around a big table.
But this is around the time when they were being called the Axis of Evil by President
Bush,
right?
That's exactly right. That's exactly right.
So was your reception warm at all, or were they hostile?
It was formal. No, it wasn't hostile by any means. It was formal. They were watching us carefully. We were being very careful that we were being watched. But it was they entertained us. They took us to several interesting cultural events. I got to visit both the National Library, which was fascinating to me, and then one of the other guys on the trip was a heart physician. I went with him to the National Hospital one day, and because they had doctor in front of my name as an economist, they assumed I was a doctor.
Mm-hmm.
So they made me put this gown on and go into this surgical thing, and I kept saying, I don't want to go. I'm not a...
At least you didn't pass out at the
no,
side of
No, I was close, though. I was very close. But so it was – there were many interesting – we weren't there a long time, but short adventures that I learned some interesting things about myself. So
your ability to blend into a wall.
Yeah, please don't make me go in there. But So the whole trip was a fascination, and I also enjoyed the fact that the State Department gave us a very good briefing and then two debriefings, one in Tokyo and one when I got back to Las Cruces. And so as a result, since that time, I've paid more attention to North Korea than I would have otherwise.
What struck you the most as far as a difference? I mean, you had been to South Korea a number of times, then you go into North Korea, and we've all, you know, you mentioned before we went on the air the satellite image of how dark it is in the north and well lit in the south. What was one of the things up close that really struck you as very different?
Two things that were obvious to me right away. First of all, Pyongyang is a city of about 3.5 million people. No streetlights or no traffic lights. Every intersection controlled by a little Korean woman in a blue uniform, which told me they had so much surplus labor that they didn't need to invest in the technology of managing traffic. They could do it with labor. So that was the first thing I thought to myself. You know, why don't they have traffic lights here? Why don't – I mean, it's a pretty good-sized city with, you know, not a lot of cars, but enough. And so I was struck by the fact that this capacity to have labor at every intersection tells you something.
Were people respectful of this person
directing
traffic?
Yeah, and they were very precise. I mean, they were all very well the choreography of directing traffic was incredibly militarily precise.
Yeah, I just could not imagine that working on 41.
No. We would be running over a lot of people.
And
then the other is we took a trip to the countryside to see a big monument to Kim Il-sung and Kim Jong-il, the founder and the first – the second president or second leader of the country. And as we're going through the countryside, what was struck me is how antiquated their agriculture was. Instead of having mechanization, they had hand harvesting of rice, people out in the rice paddy cutting rice by hand, carrying it up to the road where they thrashed it and laid it on the blacktop to dry. So they didn't have the technology that South Korea has for rice. It was like going back in time 50 or 60 years. So those two things struck me. And then the other is that the dear leader, that was the first leader, Kim Il-sung, was very fond of certain flowers, begonias in particular. So that became kind of the national flower. Well, they devoted huge amounts of agricultural productivity to flowers, despite the fact that they can just barely feed their population.
That had to just throw you as an agricultural economist.
It just stunned me that you could put greenhouse after greenhouse growing plants that were decorative at the expense of the capacity to feed a population. And so all those things kind of worked in your head to say this is a very peculiar place.
Do they have similar foods, for example? I mean, apparently not much, but North Korea to South Korea, do they have different food ways, different traditions?
No, they were pretty much very similar. And I had been to South Korea enough that I thought I could speak enough Korean to order dinner. So we were out one night and I was trying to order and I was not doing a very good job. And the governor was quite entertained by my attempt to order us a meal that we were all together. So it was one of those cases where I could order – I shouldn't say this. I could order beer and I could order – they have a liquor called mikju that's a little like sake. And I could order that and I could order rice and beef. But I ran out after that. And so he was doing a steady commentary on my lack of Korean capability. But it was nonetheless, it was a good evening.
Well, they had to respect you for at least
trying. Well, I was a try, but the waiters were chuckling. My colleagues were chuckling. Our translator was really chuckling.
Did he ever tell you what you actually said?
I'm pretty sure I insulted someone's sister, but
We are joined by FGCU President Mike Martin on today's show. We're learning that he is a man of many backgrounds, including being part of a delegation that was sent to North Korea in the mid-2000s during the George W. Bush administration. He was the education expert chosen by New Mexico Governor Bill Richardson, who led the expedition. If you'd like to join our conversation, give us a call now at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. So you were there as the expert in education. What kind of education did you see when you went there?
Well, I got to see a bit of their university system and interacted with a little of several of those people. The principal people I interacted with were part of the medical profession, and one of the things that came out of it that I did do when I got home was arrange to have three North Korean dentists come to the U.S. for further training. And so I was asking them what we could do for them as best I could. And one of the things is they wanted some more contemporary techniques in some areas. So one of the guys with us, Barry Ramo, was a heart surgeon. He brought a couple of heart surgeons. And I did some liaison to get some dentists to come for about a 5-week updating. It was very interesting because they came to visit me in Las Cruces, but they were being very carefully watched for the fear that they might defect. So it was fascinating in that regard.
It's very rare to get anybody to be able to leave.
Right? Yeah. And so, well, partly because, in effect, the regime holds their family hostage. I mean, they know that. People seem to know that quite well. So,
like if you don't go back, who you left behind is...
Is going to be in deep trouble. So. Yeah. But it was, as I say, for me it was fascination because Barry Ramo, who was a surgeon, pretty much everybody knew what he was going to look at. We also had along an expert on nuclear power, and he got the opportunity to look at a couple of their nuclear power plants. But it was I went to the library. I checked that out. I tried to see how much interaction they could have internationally on the internet, which was deeply limited even then. I mean, they were confined pretty much to what happens within North Korea. Very little capacity to contact the outside world.
I think that continued. And you talked a little bit about the men who were able to come over here to do some dental study. Yeah. And you said they didn't have much autonomy while they were here. They were watched like a hawk.
No.
Were you similarly watched when you were there?
Oh, yeah. No question. We knew we were being watched. One of the guys brought along a satellite phone thinking he could call home, but they jammed that. Oh. And we were able to call home every other morning for 15 minutes. And I know they were listening to us, but, you know, we expected that going, and we were briefed pretty well, both by the State Department and by Bill, Governor Richardson, who'd been there before. So it wasn't.
Were you ever fearful, though?
Hmm?
Were you ever fearful?
Not fearful so much as sort of intrigued by it. I'll have to. They had one quick story. We got there, and they had a series of little cars for us to drive, but the front car was a U.S. car, an older Cadillac Fleetwood, and someone had taken the D off, so it was a Fleetwood. So we were joking about the fact that they made it look like it was a local car. And the governor and I were the only two people who smoked cigars, and because of Korea's relationship with Cuba, we could get some very good cigars. So while we were traveling around, I got to ride in the Fleetwood with the governor where we smoked cigars most of the time. And I'm pretty sure that there are a couple of Koreans who are deeply suffering from secondary smoke inhalation based on the two of us. But it was just one of those peculiarities that you see. But they always had someone with us. I mean, they took us around town a little bit in Pyongyang, and a couple of us got out and walked around, took some pictures. But we were greatly limited to what we could do.
How did civilians, how did they look at you when they saw you in the street?
Well, one of the reasons they looked at us very carefully is one of the guys that was with us is a very large guy. He's about 6'8" and probably 240. So just his sheer size. But they were very respectful. I mean, we didn't get interacted with much by people on the street because they don't speak English by and large. We did have a couple of sightseeing visits where the guides spoke enough English that they could tell us a little about what's going on. For example, right downtown on the river in Pyongyang is a tower built as a monument to their first leader, Kim Il-sung. And we were told that the number of bricks in that monument were the number of days he lived. And the little woman who was giving us the tour had all kinds of information, that some of which is impossible to believe, but that they had come to believe. And she spoke English very well and was very pleasant, very nice to us, and answered a lot of questions. But with the questions were all, I'm sure it had been asked before, and were all part of almost a brainwashing. For example, she pointed out that the current leader, Kim Jong-il, had only played golf one time, but he got a hole-in-one on every hole. And we said, geez, how is that possible? And she said, well, it's just logical. I mean, that he would do that. He's so incredibly talented. And so we took it to be that if that were the case, he'd be making a lot of money on the PGA Tour.
Yeah.
And I doubt very much that he ever tried out for it. So things like that happened that we just were sort of taken aback by. But
like
also
the most inane thing.
He
did a hole in one. Yeah. And that has to be something.
And why would it matter? I mean, why would that be part of the great folklore? I mean, but that's the way they kind of function.
So what's it like right now watching the news coming out of North Korea?
It's frightening. It's frightening because one of the things you learn and we were briefed on is the regime's single most important objective is to maintain the regime. And so things like sanctions that hurt, that impact their people, may or may not have some effect. But it didn't seem to be deeply of great deep concern to them that the average citizen might be disadvantaged as long as the regime was sustained. So the regime is now 70 years old, three leaders, and they have clung to power. And I believe they will cling to power no matter what the price they have to pay. And that's frightening to me because you just don't know how far they are willing to go to sustain their control of the country.
What could make them lose control of the country? Is there anything? I mean, do the people of North Korea understand in any way that they could?
I don't know that for sure, Julie, but I find it hard to believe that there's going to be any popular uprising until something really dramatic happens. I think the best possibility that they would lose some control are one of two things. The South Korea has what's called the Sunshine Policy, which is an attempt to build relations back with North Korea, if for no other reason to reunify families that have been separated for 70 years. And so that might begin to erode to some extent the power of the regime. But the other is the impact of China. I mean, clearly China, to much lesser extent Russia, are their principal supporters and keepers of the world. Without China, I'm not sure Korea wouldn't end up with a massive disaster, both hunger and other stress. And so I think to the extent that China can influence some change or is willing to try to influence some change, I don't see much else on the horizon from where I sit. And I don't want to come across as an expert. I'm just a kind of a more intense observer than some others.
Yeah. I mean, I know you said that before. You don't want to say that you're an expert, and I understand, but having just been there is much further than most people.
Christopher Hill was the person who we dealt with. He's now a professor at the University of Denver, but he was undersecretary of state and had been the ambassador of South Korea. And they provided us at that time with some great briefing material. I mean, I learned a lot just from what I was told by the State Department going in and coming out. But I just don't see any groundswell of opposition to the regime of any substance. And they are so vicious, as you probably know. I mean, he just had his stepbrother killed. He had his uncle who was sort of his Kim Jong-un, that is, who was sort of his senior advisor killed. This is not a regime and this is not a group of people who take lightly anyone who protests against them. So they pretty much cowered people into believing that the only way the country will be sustained is to support the regime.
In some ways, the Soviet Union's collapse started when Western culture started kind of spreading among the people there. And you hear people say the same sort of thing needs to happen in North Korea. And I did a show a while back with a young woman talking about North Korea, and they were talking about market kids. And those are kids that would go to the market and could get, you know, secondhand, you know, CDs or DVDs that have been ripped. And I don't know if they still have those markets around. Did you see anything about that or any kind of dissemination of Western culture at all?
Not when I was there, but I understand that it's becoming a little more frequent because the capacity now of individuals to find ways to sort of crack the veneer has gotten better. So I wouldn't be surprised to see there's been a greater introduction of sort of Western music and Western culture, all of which has an impact. But the grip that the Kims have on this country is pretty powerful. And you know, there's sort of three messages that the great leader set out on. His philosophy was called the Juche, which is a term that means self-sufficient. We're going to be self-sufficient. And Kim Il-sung basically convinced the population and continues to work to convince the population that they live in nirvana, that there are people who are jealous of them and would take it away if they could, and the only ones who can protect them are the Kims. And that's the continual message. We're the keeper of your state in life, and this is a wonderful state in life. And if you don't let people know that there's a better state in life, they come to believe that to be true. So it's going to be tough to take them on, and I fear that there's going to be, for whatever set of reasons, an outbreak of hostility. And despite the fact that the U.S. has the muscle to do great damage, the North Koreans can do a lot of damage right over the border, right over the 38th parallel in very short order with about 11 million Koreans and several tens of thousands of Americans right there. And I don't doubt that they'd pull the trigger if they felt that they were threatened.
Would you go back if you were asked?
Yeah. Yeah, I would. I found it fascinating. And yeah, I would. I was a little nervous at the outset. Whenever someone takes your passport away, it makes you a little nervous. And then having had them keep, as you know, some people jailed for some time, there are still some Americans there now who have been accused of spying. But still, I would do it. I really did find it to be so interesting that I'd like to go back and see if I can detect any change just in my own observations.
Yes, interesting to go and then go back. Things seem to change.
Yeah, and you can do it. I mean, and principally the U.S. works through the Swedish embassy there as kind of their surrogates, and I think you could pull it off if you worked at it a bit. But I would want to go back as I did with the governor or somebody else on an official visit because I think that gives you a certain security.
A few more eyeballs on you.
Yeah, no question. And the capacity that the U.S. is tracking where you are and what you're up to.
Exactly. Okay, I'm going to do a hard pivot here. I want to switch gears and bring it close to home.
I love a hard pivot. let's see it.
Let's talk about FGCU. How did we do the school in this past legislative session?
Very well. Very well. And we owe a great deal of thanks to a number of people. First of all, the local legislative delegation rallied and came through for us. Second, a number of people helped get that done, members of our Board of Trustees, the leadership of the Board of Governors, a number of people in this community who shared their desires with our legislators. So we came out quite well. We ended up getting an increase in our operating budget, which we needed because we were underfunded relative to other institutions in the state, of $13.7 million. We ended up with $14 million toward a building we called AB9. We're now at $30 million of a $40 million project, so we're sneaking up on a building we desperately need. And then we had some other bits and pieces that help out along the way, but those were two big wins. And to have the legislature specifically assist us directly into our budget was very special. And everyone in the local delegation, I wrote a letter to this effect to the paper this week. Everyone deserves a thank you from those who care about FGCU and particularly for those who care about who FGCU serves because our students and the citizens we serve will be better off for what the delegation did.
That's got to feel good, though, for your first legislative session.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if I could be this lucky. I should have run out and bought a lottery ticket at the same time because I could make a larger donation to public radio right here at
WGCU.
That'd be great.
We'd love that. Also, you've been busy on other things, too. You started a new movement to get more students getting closer to graduation in a more timely manner. There's a whole program that you've set up.
I wouldn't say me. I'd say we. Some very good people. I put together a task force led by Dr. Mitch Cordova, and they developed a strategy and recommendations and an approach that we think will have a significant impact on allowing students to move through a very good degree, but to do it a little more expeditiously than they've done in the past.
Do you think that it made it harder for kids to just get to the end?
Yeah, I think there are a lot. I think everybody faces some barriers, and particularly our students. We got a large percentage of our students have to work. Mm-hmm. They come from not the most wealthy backgrounds. Some of them come with some challenges academically based on their high school experience. So they need a little extra help. And we're going to give them that extra help. And we're also going to try to remove every barrier that may or may not, but certainly those that may have obstructed moving through the system. We're going to try to make sure that there are always enough sections available of required courses that no one has to miss the opportunity to hit a required course going through their program.
Was part of the problem having required courses that you have to take in order to graduate not being offered often enough?
That or not having enough sections when they are offered. Whatever those things are, we're going to use summer school to help people catch up by better funding summer school, both in terms of making classes available but also scholarship funding available so that students can utilize summer to catch up.
That's how I got through undergraduate in 4 years. That's the only way I would have made it.
Well, and we need to recognize that. It's good economics for one thing because the buildings we have here are underutilized in the summer and overutilized the rest of the year. So why not spread that out a little bit while also serving students? So Mitch Cordova has agreed, having chaired the task force, to take on the task of being vice president for student success and enrollment management. And he's off and flying. And if you know Mitch Cordova, you don't hold him back. I mean, he's not a person you wouldn't hold back. You certainly don't have to motivate him because he's highly motivated to serve the students. And what I found is that across the campus, people want to do better in this regard. And so people are stepping up to help us think of new and better ways to give students an opportunity to get out in four or as minimal number of years as they possibly can.
All right. Well, I'm going to go to a break real quick, but I'm not going to say thanks and goodbye because I want you to stay with us, because when we return, we're going to be joined by Dr. H. Sheldon Weeks. He is the Department Chair of Economics and Finance at FGCU. He and Dr. Martin are going to discuss with us efforts to make students more financially literate. I'm Julie Glenn, and this is Gulf Coast Live. Stay with us. Welcome back to Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. I'm still joined in studio by Florida Gulf Coast University President Dr. Mike Martin, and I'm also joined now by Dr. H. Sheldon Weeks, Department Chair of Economics and Finance here at FGCU. We're going to spend the rest of the hour discussing the need for better financial literacy among students. Dr. Weeks, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Julie.
So tell me a little bit about financial literacy in students. What are you seeing and what is the need?
Well, The need's tremendous. When you think about financial literacy and everything that's involved with that, you know, it's really a spectrum today, and it starts with very basic functions, everything from opening a checking account to when they get out and they start making decisions about consumer credit to maybe pursuing a mortgage and hopefully starting to plan for retirement. So there's an array of very challenging issues that students face.
It seems like – I feel like I remember learning about balancing a checkbook in maybe eighth grade at Exchange City in my middle school. Are kids not doing that anymore in high school and middle school?
You know, I don't think we have as much of it today as we did before. And part of that relates to the technology and sort of how we conduct our daily lives. You know, if you look at a student today that may be in high school – and I'll pick on my own son for an example. Instead of opening a checking account and teaching him to balance a checking account, in today's world, it's much easier to give him a credit card so that he never even really deals with cash. And I think having that cash in hand when we were younger, it made us very cognizant of what we were doing, what we were spending, and being financially responsible. Today, the easy way, and again, my family's just as guilty of this as anyone, is to hand them a credit card and say, okay, be mindful of what you spend. But it doesn't really have the same effect. It doesn't sink in the same way for a young person.
That's really true. I remember with the advent of the ATM, my budget really took a few hits there because you just don't really realize it is leaving your hands or your checkbook because you're not balancing it every day.
Exactly. And then those problems just kind of compound as we move on. If you think about the world for a college student, they get here and as soon as they have a little money coming in, maybe from a part-time job or something, they start getting credit card applications. And they have lots of opportunity to have credit extended to them, but then they don't really know how to use that prudently. And it's very easy to fall into a trap of building up too much consumer debt too quickly.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Martin, when you were going through high school and undergraduate college, do you remember when you started learning about all this?
Well, when I was going through, we were still mostly exchanging money with gold coins and
doubloons.
Yeah, doubloons and Birch Bark we rode on a lot of where I grew up. I think we all had the similar experience of what Sheldon has suggested, that we had a little more hands-on with the real thing, and it was real to us. And you know, some of us who wanted to go into college, for example, knew that we had to save some of it, and that was a force to recognize in your own life. And as a result, you early on began to manage it a little bit better. And I do think we have now the capacity to use credit in ways that we had never fully anticipated nor trained people for. I think he's exactly right. And we also always have to keep up with changing technology, whether it's credit cards or other things. I mean, I'm not buying any Bitcoin, but who knows what's out there in the future for some of those kinds of experiments.
I don't know. I'm scared of Bitcoin, although I shouldn't speak that way. But there are so many people that are really big believers in that. So I wanted to ask how this topic is approached here at FGCU. Is there a class that kids are going through or
At this point, we don't have a formal class for financial literacy. We have, of course, a finance major, and a lot of our finance students, when they go out and do their community service work that they're required to do here at FGCU, participate in programs that help with financial literacy. For example, we've got a group of students that are partnering with the FPA, the Financial Planners Association of Southwest Florida, and I think this will be the second year where they're going down to Grace Place in Collier County and helping with financial literacy for members of the Hispanic community. So we have some students that are doing things like that, but for our own student body, we don't necessarily have a defined class in financial literacy.
Mm-hmm. Is this something that parents should be tackling a little bit more closely as when the kids are first coming of age and getting their first jobs?
Well, I think that we certainly have a burden as parents to do that. However, when we think about the parents, and particularly think about the demographic for our students, they're probably a lot of the parents that still need help with financial literacy. And we see that. If you think back to the economic downturn that we saw here in Southwest Florida, there were a large number of families that struggled with choices that they had made that reflected a lack of financial sophistication, particularly in regards to mortgage products and the debt level that the families had. And that all relates directly to financial literacy, being able to make that choice between a 30-year fixed-rate mortgage or a mortgage with an adjustable rate, even the timing decision of when to buy a first home. All of that relates to financial literacy.
And so it's more than just interest rates on a Discover card.
Absolutely.
Are there still Discover cards?
I think so.
I know that was my first one, and that was in college.
Yeah. I only have the ones my wife allows me to have, and so I don't have Discover. But I think the point is well made, because it's not just this sort of the management of those kinds of transactions. It's just a thought process that goes into it. I've got an almost 40-year-old son. He's a couple of days away from being 40 years old, and he and I have had this conversation about how do you make a decision between buying or leasing a car? What economics do you bring to bear on that decision? Or I did this with him not too long ago. When you rent a car, when do you decide whether or not you're going to pay for a full tank of gas going out or you fill it up coming back? What are your economic criteria for making some of those really simple little decisions that save you some money one way or the other, but that we sort of take for granted because someone talked us into it? And so
that's the thing with the housing thing. You know, you're sitting there at the bank and they're saying this is the best way to go. Well, they're not going to advise you to do what makes them the least amount of money.
And so you have to have a framework to start by making some of those decisions, at least based on some rational process that I think we need to continue to work on. And I'm not entirely sure we shouldn't have a class going out of here. There's just sort of life skills we teach people, some simple things in life if they haven't gotten them already. And I think
home ec, really.
Yeah, yeah. And I think Dr. Weeks has touched on some of the most critical ones, because I'm not sure people go out as well prepared as we wish they were. And I'm not entirely sure we can leave it to families to get that done either.
That is true. And that's a tough one. I mean, what is one of the biggest mistakes, Dr. Weeks, that you see students making while they're still in college? And then how do college loans factor into this?
Well, I think by far the biggest mistake is ending up with too much consumer debt and then coupling that with a lot of student debt, you know, so that when they leave here, their balance sheet is way out of whack and it takes them years to recover. If they are able to recover, many of them end up in bankruptcy because they're not able to manage that debt load.
So they have the debt load of the student debt and then also the regular consumer debt because of those credit cards that are appealing to them.
That's right. The credit's extended readily, and many times the amounts are much more than they can manage, and it's painless to use the credit card. And then at the end of the day, when the bill's due, you've got to come up with cash. And if they haven't been taught about that responsibility growing up, they're not prepared to handle it.
You mean paying the balance every
month?
That's
correct.
Instead of letting it float and sit there and—
That's correct. They get into that cycle where the interest is compounding month after month, and they can't get out of it.
But it's so hard, though, when you're talking to a young person who is newly independent, is not having a parent looking over their shoulder and telling them what to do. So then they end up in a situation where I want this, and I'm a big person now, and now I have this card, and I want to enjoy my life because I studied so hard this week, you know?
And I think that's one of the challenges. It's incremental. each one of those purchases seems small, and it may seem small in and of itself.
Yes, like I need this $8 Frappuccino or whatever.
Exactly, exactly. Until those things begin to – and as suggested, not only do you continue to add to that debt, but the interest you're paying on it is so high, generally speaking, that that just becomes a cycle that's almost impossible to reverse.
And you don't really – and the students may not even realize this until they're about to graduate and they're looking at a huge debt plus their student loan.
That's right. I think about myself when I was at that age. I was very fortunate to have parents that were able to provide for me. But still, the financial decisions that I made, they were far from sound many times. So that's just part of being young.
Yeah.
And we make mistakes. The problem is when you make these financial mistakes, they stay with you for a long time, and it's really difficult to recover.
Are the mistakes bigger now than they used to be?
I think the potential for them to be bigger now is definitely there.
Is that because of the lack of the tactile, I am now spending $20 because I'm handing you a $20 bill?
I think so. And I think that could get even easier. You know, I'm a bit of a slug when it comes to technology. So my wife was making fun of me this weekend when I was looking at the technology that's out there for pay with face recognition on your smartphone. I really didn't know that we were as close to that as we are.
Wow.
But if you think about how easy it is to pay with a credit card, and we go to being able to use facial recognition on your smartphone to pay a bill, it's going to get even easier. So I think that trend could continue.
And I think there is kind of a march of consumerism. I'm sitting here looking at my my Apple Watch that my kids gave me.
Mm-hmm.
And they gave it to me more, I think, out of entertainment on their own case because they treat me like Mr. Magoo. But it's true. I got this incredibly expensive watch that does all kinds of things I don't need to have done. I mean, I really don't. It does my heart rate, right?
Sometimes I don't want to know that.
Well, the only time I care if it goes to zero. I mean, other than that, I'm okay with it. But we get caught up in this, and I wouldn't. I don't want. They'll probably hear that. I would never have bought this for myself. I just wouldn't have done it.
We just won't send them a link to this show.
I just wanted to know the time. But we can get caught up in that, and every little feature adds to it, and we all feel as though we have to have it now, or many do.
Yeah.
And so I think there's that cycle of kind of getting caught up in more and more and more, and the cost at the margin is relatively small, so what the heck, I'll add it on, and pretty soon it's a pretty big bill.
Yeah, culturally we are kind of in a bit of a pickle because technology has taken us away from the recognition of the spending and the interest and all of that. Do you feel like kids, maybe because they're doing things online and they're all into the tech, that because they're not looking at those numbers every day, they barely probably even look at the bank statements. I know sometimes I don't even look at mine because I just know I've got enough to get through for the next couple of weeks. But do you feel like that combined with capitalism in American society, and it seems like it's gotten even more now, and I don't know if I'm becoming an old guy saying get off my lawn here or not, but it kind of seems that way.
Well, I think that the ease of consumption is higher today than it ever has been. I mean, if you think about everything you can buy from the chairs we're sitting in right now, how much money can we spend without leaving this room? It's incredible. So for the young person out there facing those choices, there's really not a lot to slow them down when it comes to consumption. And it goes back to very basic economics. When we start thinking about saving, delaying consumption so that we can have greater consumption in the future, that's really where it starts. And because of the technological leaps that we've been able to make over the last decade or so, that trade-off is not as easily viewable for the individual. They just see this immediate consumption, it's that gratification that's right there. So it makes it a little harder.
It's tempting also when you've been, you know, anxious and undergoing finals and putting together your thesis and I really do deserve to have this thing. You know, it's hard not to do that. So there's not currently a course, and this kind of what maybe sounds like we're kind of working towards something along those lines. But what is there that's available for students right now that want to learn a little bit about financial literacy?
Well, right now in the business core, we have a business finance class that all the students take that teaches them about the time value of money, risk and return, and gives them the tool set that they could use to analyze any of these financial decisions. The problem is That's only for the business students.
Can other students take it if they want to?
They'd have to go through a long series of prereqs to get there, to have the tools to be able to make their way through that. Now, one of the courses that we've got on the books that we haven't had the staffing to be able to run that, you know, maybe if we hit somebody up around here for some extra resources.
Sorry.
I knew that was coming up somehow, Sheldon.
That's why we had you stick around for that.
I can see that coming, yeah, but I get it. Good.
But we do have a personal finance class for non-business majors that at some point we'd love to run. But honestly, the growth has been such around here that we haven't been able to run it yet. But that's something that could at least be a first step
something
in
down
addressing
the road.
These issues. Absolutely.
Exactly. Well, that's all the time that we have for today's show, but I want to thank my guests. Dr. Mike Martin is the president of Florida Gulf Coast University. Dr. Martin, thank you so much for your time.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
I also want to thank Dr. H. Sheldon Weeks, in the department chair of economics and finance here at FGCU. Dr. Weeks, thanks also to you.
Thank you, Julie.
Our show today was produced by Mike and Ira, Rachel Iacovone, and myself. Our director is Richard Chin Kui. Our social media coordinator is Tara Callaghan. Gulf Coast Live is made possible through the generous support of the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation. For now, thanks for listening. I'm Julie Glenn. This is WGCU-FM, Fort Myers, 90.1, WMKO, Marco Island, 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida.